For weeks in the late spring and early summer, Rumsfeld and other officials declined to say that they were facing a continuing war in Iraq. His exchanges with reporters during this period underscored what one defense expert termed the institutional resistance to thinking seriously about the situation. Rumsfeld's refusal to say he was facing war sent a signal downward across the military establishment, that most hierarchical of institutions, built to act on the words and views of those at the top. More than at any other time in the painful history of the U.S. intervention in Iraq, even more than during the formulation of the war plan, that late spring was the point at which Rumsfeld might have made a decisive difference. Some in the military saw Rumsfeld as a strong leader, while others disparaged him as a bully. In either case, it was at this point that his strong personality could have been useful in forcing the U.S. military to understand that it was caught in a counterinsurgency campaign and would need to make wrenching adjustments to win, just as other conventional militaries had in similar situations. Instead, Rumsfeld's self-confident stubbornness made him a big part of the problem. The defense secretary's vulnerability wasn't that he made errors. It was that he seemed unable to recognize them and make adjustments. As Baghdad was looted, the defense secretary seemed to freeze. Rumsfeld was having difficulty recognizing the reality of what was happening in Iraq, and instead was arguing powerfully for his mistaken point of view. Donald Rumsfeld is a remarkably complex study, with huge reservoirs of talent and intelligence, marred by towering hubris, retired Army Colonel Lloyd Matthews, a former editor of Parameters, the Army's premier journal, commented that summer. He's up, he's down, and he'll continue in this sine wave pattern throughout his public career, and very likely be down at the end, because he fails to realize that despite his gifts, he is in a business where defeats are inevitable, where all victories are fleeting, and where one's best defense is the homely quality of grace and humility which he so sorely lacks. On June 19, Rumsfeld appeared at the Pentagon briefing room, Garner standing by his side. He wouldn't call the situation in Iraq a war. There's no question but that in those regions where pockets of dead-enders are trying to reconstitute, General Franks and his team are rooting them out. He also engaged in a verbal sleight of hand about the 42 U.S. soldiers who had died in Iraq in the previous 6 weeks since Bush's declaration that the war was over. Look, you've got to remember that if Washington, D.C. were the size of Baghdad, we would be having something like 215 murders a month, he said. There's going to be violence in a big city. It's 5.5 million people. In fact, there probably were many more murders than that in the chaos of Baghdad. It wasn't unusual at the time to see cars swerving around a dead body lying in morning traffic. What Rumsfeld was looking at were the statistics on the deaths of U.S. troops, that is, the people trying to bring security to the area. So the equivalent would not be the murder rate in the general population, but among law enforcement personnel. If 215 police officers were being killed monthly in Washington, D.C., it would be regarded as a major crisis, as indeed was the case in Baghdad at the time, despite Rumsfeld's anodyne insistence that the coalition is making good progress. On the same day, Wolfowitz, testifying on Capitol Hill, portrayed the nascent insurgency as remnants of the old regime. He told the House Armed Services Committee, "I think these people are the last remnants of a dying cause."